that's good. Cool. So I'll just start with some questions I have about Noah and like when you first met him.
Sure.
So when I was talking to him, I remember he said by the time he got to Dodge County and he realized he was in Wisconsin, he was just like so depressed he didn't even want to leave like his cell, and even when he heard about the law clinic, and so he didn't even want to come, but he finally decided to. So when you met him, like what was your first impression of him when you saw him?
When I first met him, so when we're in Dodge, I greet people and then place them with students. And I remember asking him after, you know, who was the first person you spoke to? And he was like, Aaron, it was you. And all you did was ask if I spoke English. And I was like, oh, that wasn't super welcoming, I'm sure. But then he immediately went and sat with one of our students, Maggie. And about 10 minutes after they were talking, she came back to me with tears in her eyes and said, Aaron, we have to help him. And reading his story and talking to him that day, I knew that it was a case that we should be taking, and Maggie was the student who would be working on it.
So what was it about his case that you knew you would be able to help, or like stood out compared to other cases?
So compared to other cases, there are some cases at Dodge where people have criminal convictions that maybe make it tougher to qualify for immigration benefits, or they have like a border violation or something like that. But Guad didn't have any of that. And what I would say of what I learned from this case, he had what would be a textbook asylum case. It was one of the strongest asylum cases I've ever seen. And I knew that we should, we would be able, I hoped that we would be able to represent him and assist him in being receiving asylum and eventually reuniting with his family as well.
Gotcha. So what are those kind of points for asylum that made it so textbook?
So he was, he fled Cameroon based on persecution, past persecution because of his political beliefs. And the evidence was strong. There not only is country reports and expert reports that we were able to present, but he also wears scars on his body that we were able to demonstrate were linked to the persecution that he suffered from the government in Cameroon.
Gotcha. So can you also kind of walk me through like a typical asylum case? Like what does that look like? How long does it take? And also kind of how does that compare to you applying for a green card, for
right.
example?
So there's no way to really, for me to articulate a normal asylum case, because over the past, especially since Trump was president, it's changed substantially, and it seems to change substantially every few months. Including now with their current policies that have been changing through the power of the executive office. But when we met him, I looked at it as like a normal detained defensive asylum claim, meaning he's in deportation proceedings and we'll represent him, and eventually he'll present his case in front of an immigration judge, and if he gets asylum, then he'll be released from detention and will be in a pathway to citizenship. So after 1 year of being an asylee, you can apply for your green card, and then 4 years after, you can apply to become a U.S. citizen. But when he entered, it was at the peak of the most restrictive asylum policies implemented by President Trump, including a safe third country transit ban, which means if you pass through a third country on the way to the United States and didn't apply for asylum in one of those countries, and then you would try to apply for asylum at the southern border, you're barred from receiving asylum. And that's what he was facing. Even though any other time I would have met him, I would have said, we're gonna go, you know, to your hearing in 3 months after we prepared everything, and you're gonna get asylum. I'm confident you are. I would never say 100%. But because of the policies under the Trump administration, they barred him from having asylum. So we had to change strategies, and the first thing we wanted to do was to get him out of detention. And that's almost impossible for people that are considered, under the law, arriving aliens. They are people who present themselves at the southern border to seek asylum. They're subject to mandatory detention. So Gua was subject to mandatory detention. But because of his good character and his family ties in the U.S., he had a cousin here, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, actually agreed to parole him into the United States, which shocked us, but then allowed him to not have to remain in detention during the pendency of his asylum case. And so normally when someone's in detention, we're going to have their final asylum hearing 4 to 5 months after they are detained there. Once someone is released from detention and they are applying for asylum but not detained, it can take years. And that's what it did in Gua's case. The only reason he has asylum now is we requested for an expedited hearing. Otherwise, he probably would have still been waiting 5 or 6 years later.
Wow, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, So I remember talking to him as well, and he was saying how he didn't even know he was in Wisconsin until months after, because he said the most confusing part of his whole journey here was honestly getting to the U.S. border and getting traveling from there to Wisconsin. How often does that happen with people?
It's super common. People that are detained at the Dodge County Correctional Facility here in Wisconsin are from all over the world. Many of them are from Wisconsin and surrounding states. Illinois doesn't have any detention centers anymore, so there are people from many other states who have been living in other states. But also, when we are bringing people from the southern border to be detained, they can be from all over the world. We meet people from Afghanistan, from China, from Cameroon, from Cote d'Ivoire, from Venezuela, really all over the world. And they have no idea why they're in Dodge County, Wisconsin, and really where that is. I mean, we're closer to Canada than we are to Mexico. So it can be really disorienting to them.
Totally. So since you've been a lawyer, how have you seen immigration policies, people come through? How has that changed over the past 5 years, past 10 years?
Over the past 5 years, it's become much more restrictive, and all of the policies have become more complicated, especially as they relate to asylum. When Trump became president, it felt like there was very little I could do to represent someone to qualify for asylum. And meeting Gua during that time was almost paralyzing, because I knew that our laws and our international agreements should allow him to have safety within the United States and to eventually be reunited with his family. But as it stood the day that I met him, that was impossible.
So going along with the policies, what is your reaction to the Biden executive order that temporarily shuts off access along the border, especially for asylum seekers?
I'm not surprised that there is a more restrictive policy that is coming across even from Biden's office, because it has become so politicized and there's so much misunderstanding about the border. You know, all we do is hear influx and emergency, and but we're really forgetting about that this is a humanitarian issue, and that as the United States, we have laws that allow people to seek protection here when they will be persecuted or have been persecuted in their home country. And now we're just blocking that off again for many people that will be, would otherwise be eligible for protections in the U.S. But as a political, the political nature of immigration right now is, I think this is, by restricting things at the border is the only way someone is going to gain popularity with the general population, even though that's incredibly disheartening.
Yeah, totally. And so oftentimes these immigrants return back to their home countries where it could be unsafe. What does that mean for someone like Gua, who could have, this potentially could have been him if it had been a few years earlier?
Right. Well, I mean, when Gua entered the United States, he entered in a very, it was an emergent situation. He had just been, survived an attempted kidnapping. And prior to that, he was stuck in Mexico under the migrant protection protocols. So he would have had to remain in Matamoros, Mexico, which is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. And he would have had to remain there for a long time. But after he was beaten and almost kidnapped, he begged a Customs Border Protection officer to allow him to enter the United States and be detained there during the asylum process versus staying in Mexico, where he knew his life was very much in danger. And we believe, and I've talked to Gua about this, that the only reason they did eventually let him in, beyond that he, you know, had physical wounds and his health was in danger, he spoke English well. And so he was able to communicate fully with the Customs Border Protection Office. Gua's articulate, he's intelligent, he's kind. I think all of those, his ways of communicating really allowed him to not remain in Mexico during the pendency of his asylum hearing. But if I think about him being returned to Mexico at a day like today, I'm not sure he would have survived. There is so much danger to migrants in these border cities because they are targets. Many of them, you know, they may travel with some money, but it's not much money. But the gangs and the narcotraficantes, they are controlling many of those areas, and they know how to target individuals who are extremely vulnerable on their journey to seek safety in the U.S. And beyond that, there's a lot of, what I've witnessed and what has been reported, there's a lot of racism also in Mexico for migrants from African countries, in particular, you know, those who look like Gua. And so he experienced a lot of that on his journey as well. And I think at first he thought it was because he didn't speak Spanish, and later he realized it was because of the color of his skin. So the danger that he would face if he was forced to remain in Mexico during this time, or if he had been returned to Cameroon, he would not have survived.
Yeah. So what does that mean for people who are now unable to cross the border, who are at the border right now? What does it look like for them? What are the implications of this policy?
So right now, the Biden administration is attempting to have everyone process for asylum through an app, a CBP One app. And so when I go to the border, I meet with people who are in the process of waiting for an appointment to then go and ask the U.S. if they can apply for asylum within the U.S. People are waiting for months to just get an appointment with CBP One in order to process. And so they're living in Tijuana. I visited shelters where people are leaving, but you also see people just living in tent cities. They're waiting there with some hope that they one day will be able to enter the U.S., but those that are waiting for the CBP One app are waiting a long time. And those that are crossing irregularly without a CBP One app are often targeted by criminal organizations or being, you know, smuggled and paying people exorbitant amounts of money in order to attempt to cross the U.S. So the dangers and the desperation are evident everywhere you look and with everyone you meet. And while increasing options for more regular migration, I do think, is a solution, it's not happening enough. There are not enough safe routes for people to seek protection.
Yeah, so how dangerous are those routes? Because people will still try to cross regardless, right? So what happens to them?
The death rate at the border right now is incredibly high. People face, you know, the elements, but also criminals. You know, there's so much danger that people face, but people are desperate. And so in order, they're risking their lives because they have no other choice.
Yeah. I think that's kind of all the questions I have. Is there anything else you want to talk about? I mean, I guess when you go to these countries, like, what's your goal when you're meeting these people, your clients? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want to help them with?
So we have a new project. It's called Safe Passage from the Darien Gap. And the focus of the project is to look at ways to mitigate the dangers that people face when they are coming from south of the Darien Gap, so in Colombia, a similar journey that Gua did. And he was actually one of the inspirations for this because of everything he suffered during his journey. And also, I've met a number of people that he was on the journey with, and they talk about how he saved their life. You know, he's a strong, compassionate, strong leader. And so learning about that, but then learning about all the hardships that he went through and the discrimination and that people even survived the journey is incredible. But we're looking at ways to of harm reduction. How can we reduce harm to people like Wa who have these strong asylum cases in order to see if there's a way that they can get to the U.S. with asylum in a regular route without having to risk their lives in order to get to the southern border, because there's really no other options. And so in a few countries right now, including Colombia, Costa Rica, Guatemala, there are these safe offices, so safe mobility offices. And so Biden has opened up these regular routes of migration so people can apply with the United Nations or with the IOM, so International Office of Migration, to receive benefits while they're in Colombia, and then they can fly to the U.S. So if Wa had been afforded the opportunity to apply for asylum in Colombia with the United Nations, then he wouldn't have had to risk all of it. And then he would have arrived in the U.S. without needing a court date because he already would have been deemed a refugee. And so Biden is starting to do some of these, opening these regular migration routes that increase safety and also encourage people with strong asylum claims to apply for asylum earlier or refugee status earlier. So we're really looking at that and hoping that there's ways that we can increase these opportunities for people to seek, have a safe passage to the U.S. The problem is it's very limited on who can apply and how many people are able to process, but it's a start. And so we're really looking at those factors and seeing what other ways we can mitigate the danger that people are facing. And one of that is also information campaigns. So that people actually know before they risk their lives whether they can be, whether they may be eligible for asylum in the U.S. Because a lot of people who are coming, they don't necessarily know what the law is. Gua did. He studied before he came. He knew what U.S. asylum law. He knew that he should qualify for protection. But many people are coming, get misinformation, whether it's from their governments or from criminal organizations that benefit from the money that people pay to take this dangerous journey. So trusted information is really important, and we're hoping to be part of that, those information campaigns that will allow people to have trusted information before they choose to risk their life.
Yeah, totally. That was going to be my next question. Like, how do you get that information out to people, either just through word of mouth, and how does that add to the confusion also?
Right. So one thing we're starting to do is we're collaborating with law schools in Mexico and Colombia to do transnational immigration clinics. So when we were in Colombia in February, I brought five of my students, and then we worked with an immigration clinic at Universidad de los Andes, which is a really amazing law school, highly reputable. And what we did is we went out to the community and met with people who had questions about both Colombian protections and U.S. protections. Because Colombia, about five years ago, didn't really have people that were wanting to stay there. But with Venezuela, it all changed. And so there are options for asylum in Colombia. There are options for temporary status for certain people in Colombia. And so for some people who aren't going to qualify for asylum in the U.S., it may be better for them to stay in Colombia. But doing these transnational clinics, they are able to meet with a U.S. Attorney who can advise on the U.S. law as well as a Colombian attorney so that they can have agency in their choice and say, okay, doesn't sound like my case would allow me to qualify for asylum, so maybe I'll look at staying in Colombia. Or I have a very strong case for asylum in Colombia. Asylum in the U.S. How am I going to process that? And do I want to risk my life to go through the Darien Gap and to reach the southern border? But just sharing trusted information, providing ability for people to have agency in their decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's pretty much all I have. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with Noah?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Great.
But thank you.
Yeah, thank you.